disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, October 24th, 2018. This episode, we speak with Scott Campbell on the caravan from Honduras, which has now crossed into Mexico and is headed for the United States. We speak about the history of such caravans and, moreover, how economic neoliberal policies and U.S. imperialism has created the conditions which push many people to migrate across entire countries in search of work and to escape political repression. We then talk to somebody involved in the group Alliance Against Displacement from so-called British Columbia, who discusses struggles around homelessness, the creation of tent cities, building takeovers, and organizing efforts against local far-right groups such as the Soldiers of Odin. But first, let's get to some headlines. Several days ago, around the same time that Trump was calling himself a nationalist during one of his many rallies, news broke that a bomb had been sent to the home of billionaire hedge fund manager, DNC backer, and liberal philanthropist George Soros, long the boogeyman puppet master of many an anti-Semitic meme. Then today, news broke that more packages, similar to the one sent to George Soros, had been sent to the home of the Clintons, the Obamas, and a CNN office. Other possible packages are also being investigated currently. Pro-Trump and alt-right message boards have already been placed into high gear since the George Soros bombing and began to push a line that all of the bombings were, quote, false flags, seemingly carried out by a desperate DNC to scare voters into punishing Trump. This talking point of false flag attacks was then picked up by the far-right pundit class, as Ann Coulter wrote today that from the Haymarket riot to the Unabomber, bombs are a liberal tactic. And on the radio, Rush Limbaugh was telling his audiences that Democrats were behind the bombings in order to win in the midterms, and now even Fox News has begun to back the conspiracy. In reality, in the last several years, bombs have been a favorite of the far-right, militia movement, and the alt-right. 2016, a group of 3%er militia members were arrested for plotting to blow up an apartment complex in a mosque used by Somali immigrants. 2017, members of Adam Waffen were caught with materials for a dirty bomb, framed photos of Timothy McVeigh, and plans to attack a nuclear power plant. A 3%er was arrested for attempting to blow up a bank in Oklahoma City. An Unicorn Riot revealed that members of the group Anticom were trading information on bomb-making materials and openly planning to attack federal buildings. This is to say nothing of the bomb attacks that have taken place against mosques in 2018 and the years prior. These bombings also have taken place against a backdrop of an escalated push by the Trump administration to attack a wide range of communities that the regime sees as enemies, from attempting to legislate trans people out of existence to claiming that George Soros and the Democrats are behind the migrant caravan that is currently headed into the United States. With that in mind, let's get to resistance and repression news. On October 16th, anarchists and abolitionists demonstrated in Rochester, New York against the police. Talk by Henry Kissinger was disrupted. And on October 17th, a Portland activist had their house attacked for the second time. The attack is suspected to be carried out by lead Proud Boy Tiny Tosay. On October 19th, supporters organized a calling campaign for Kevin Rashid Johnson after he was moved again by prison officials. More information can be found in our show notes. Posters went up in New Orleans against the Proud Boys, who were reported to be in town for an event and meetup. In Orange County of California, quote, inmates in Orange County Jail say they've launched a second hunger strike this year to protest the alleged misuse of solitary confinement. Some inmates at the Theo Lacey facility and the county's intake release center started to refuse food at breakfast on Wednesday, Sheriff's Department spokesperson said. Inmates plan to refuse meal trays and refrain from buying commissary snacks for 3 to 4 days to get the message across, said Philippe Salone. We are protesting the overall treatment or mistreatment of inmates of all ethnic backgrounds, Salone told LAist in a phone interview. We are still human beings. We've got constitutional rights. On October 21st, Ram in New York City paid tribute to the anarchist revolutionary who recently fell in Rojava. They wrote, Saheed Shaheen, also known as Waka, fell fighting Daesh, also known as ISIS, in Rojava. Anarchists and revolutionaries internationally must lift up his name and memory in our push for revolution everywhere. Long live Waka. The Marriott strike by hotel workers continues across 7 time zones. In many cases, people are needed to support fellow workers on the picket lines and keep scabs from coming into the buildings. In Portland, Rose City Antifa celebrated 11 years of existence with musical guests and raised over $800 for anti-fascist legal and medical fees. In St. Louis, demonstrations and protests continued against the workhouse jail, which last year led to clashes with the police and protests from inside the facility over lack of air conditioning. On October 22nd, more documents were filed that shows that the prosecution during the J20 trial attempted to hide the connection between Project Veritas and the police. Grit Post published an article about how New York Antifa had exposed deep connections between alt-right Proud Boys and local Republican Party officials and volunteers. A rally was held outside the courthouse where the Vaughn 17 trial is starting. Unicorn Ride is also on the scene providing coverage throughout the trial. On October 23rd, Mike Africa, one of the Move 9, was finally freed and was released in the loving arms of his wife and son. The campaign against Casey Cooper, a white nationalist law student in Atlanta, Georgia, continues, with anti-fascists now putting up stickers around the campus. In Carbondale, Illinois, over 150 people gathered against Trump, threats by the far right, and also the city council shutting down in the face of such threats. Folks held a community assembly, and there was reports of scattered fascists who quickly left the area. Trump is scheduled to give a speech in the next town over on Saturday at an airport after canceling in Carbondale itself. Here's a closing statement read by somebody from the Flyover Social Center at the end of last night's assembly. This is from their Facebook page. Tonight, we did not make an official city resolution. An official city resolution has to be voted on by the city council and go through the proper channels. We didn't do that. Tonight, we did something more important. We made a pact. A pact to stand together against those who would oppress us. A pact to stand up to those who would target the most vulnerable among us. A pact to build our lives together, here in this town, on our own terms. A pact is a promise. It doesn't exist on paper. It exists between us. It exists only as long as we keep it alive between us. Fascism in America didn't start with Trump. The groundwork for this moment has been a bipartisan effort laid for 50 years. And even that was just a repetition of the same things that have been with us since the founding of this country in genocide and slavery. A racial and patriarchal system that has survived by transforming itself in every generation. This is nothing new. But what is new is that we no longer have time to wait. The fascist strategy is clear. In the face of ecological catastrophe, of massive inequality, of global turmoil, they aim to lock the human species into their hierarchies forever. They aim to destroy any possibility of a free and beautiful world that we want. And they are on course to succeed unless people like us, towns like ours, stop them. We are not just whiny liberals. Some of us, myself included, aren't even liberals. We are not crazy terrorists. The terrorists we experience comes from these fascists, from the police, from the corporations they defend. We are not even Americans. We're deeper than that. We're earthlings. We are beings whose world is threatened. And we are beings who make new worlds, as we have over and over again for 100,000 years. That is what we are, and we are people who find ourselves in a place marked by an extraordinary astronomical coincidence. We are here in this time between two eclipses. And we have a lot of work to do to build a free and equal and dignified world before our time to do so runs out. Thank you for being here. This pact is just beginning. In Oakland, yet another condo development was set on fire, an act of arson, many claim. If so, this would make it the 9th arson-related attack on condo development in the rapidly gentrifying Bay Area of California. In Long Beach, California, a large and rowdy anti-fascist crowd protested outside of Turning Point USA's Campus Clash speaking event. And finally, on October 24th, Appalachians Against Pipeline celebrated the 50th day of the latest tree sit in the Hellbender Autonomous Zone. We want to remind people that we are fundraising right now in order to continue this project. If you value IGD, then please make a one-time donation or sign up to become a monthly supporter of this project and ensure that we will be around for the long haul. Thanks for joining us and enjoy the interviews. Okay, we're joined here today with Scott Campbell. Scott's been a guest on the show before, talking about issues in Mexico and beyond. We're going to be talking real briefly just about the caravan that's happening, just kind of put it into a context. But Scott, I guess the first thing to ask is who organizes these caravans? Are these self-organized or are these set up by groups or unions?
In general, the caravans, it depends on which caravan. There's not a certain organization or network of organizations that puts together all the caravans we've been seeing. There was a caravan earlier this year that was organized in part by Pueblos Sin Fronteras, which is a group based in Tijuana, along with migrant support groups and networks throughout Mexico and Central America. This one is a little different in that it was, according to reports, initially somewhat self-organized in that different folks were talking on WhatsApp and Facebook about heading north to the U.S. And a journalist and former lawmaker in Honduras who does a lot of work around supporting immigrants was trying to organize these people who initially numbered around 200. And the pro-government media got a hold of this and started telling people that if they showed up in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, that their transportation would be paid for, that their food would be paid for, and to try and make it look like this was something organized by the opposition to make the Honduran government look bad. It somewhat backfired when people actually really started showing up in throngs, but initially was sort of started by some misinformation, and then it's gained force as it's moved along, and people just feel it's a lot safer to travel in a large group. They don't have to pay for a coyote, and they have the power in numbers. So as it's moved along, just more and more people have joined up.
Yeah, because I think there's a perception right now that that these are somehow new things or this is only coming about under Trump. But in reality, these caravans have been ongoing for a long time. And this is just the latest one. I think the current one has like 7,000 people or so. And
that's right. Yeah.
And a lot of it is women with children and children. I'm just curious. I mean, can you lay out for people like, you know, the causes that are pushing a lot of these people to join these caravans? I mean, this isn't something that most people would just like, yeah, I'm going to walk across several countries and face riot police and then, you know, come up against the government with, you know, a person like Donald Trump that, you know, is saying that they're going to send the military after us. I mean, most people would not want to do that. So what's driving these people to, you know, do this?
Absolutely. And you're right. It's that, like most people don't just get up and say, hey, I'm going to travel 2,000 miles to a foreign country where the government has made clear its hatred for my existence. And the fact that it's grown between 5 and 7,000 people shows just how dire these conditions are, that so many people can get mobilized. It shows that the issue of migration and having to flee one's country is on a lot of people's minds already, and it's already in the works or in different stages of happening. Anyways, it's not that people are like, hey, this sounds like a fun Facebook event, I'm going to go attend. It's a life or death matter, right?
Right.
And so it's basically like most of the people traveling in the caravan are from Honduras, but some are from El Salvador as well as Guatemala. And now that they're in Mexico, it's likely that some Mexicans might join up. But what we see are people just risking their lives, traveling through hostile territory to a hostile entity that simply because they're left with no other options, or at least this seems like the least worst of terrible options. In Honduras, the poverty rate is at 66%, so 2/3 of the people live in poverty. We've seen a coup regime backed by the United States being in place since 2009. We've seen massive repression of social movements, including, of course, the well-known murder of Berta Cáceres, who was opposing a dam and fighting for the rights of her indigenous people. And not only is that occurring in Honduras, but it's also occurring in El Salvador and Guatemala and in Mexico as well. And it's not a coincidence that the Honduran government, the Guatemalan government, and the Mexican government are all now responding to Trump's sort of call to arms against these folks who are mobilizing to save their lives and their children's lives in search of something better, and cracking down, shutting down borders, arresting people, firing tear gas, beating them, etc., as they just try and seek out something better for themselves and their family.
Right. I believe I read it was, you know, Mexico that sent out, you know, massive amounts of riot police, you know, basically on the bequest of Trump to basically stop the caravan from getting into Mexico. And, you know, it didn't succeed. But I mean, that's a great point that you bring up, that, you know, so much of these conditions are caused by U.S. imperialism and U.S. intervention and also U.S. economic policy. Is there anything else you could say to that? Just, you know, how U.S. meddling, you know, either through, you know, something like, you know, the IMF or structural adjustment programs, or through like actual regime change, has led to these conditions that is forcing these people to seek lives in the United States?
Sure. Well, U.S. intervention in Central America, of course, goes back more than a century with the Monroe Doctrine and the numerous U.S. invasions of Nicaragua, Honduras, the coup in Guatemala in the 50s, the coup in 2009 in Honduras, and, of course, the training of the Contras in Nicaragua via Honduras. There's just a nonstop legacy of U.S. intervention and meddling in Central America in the hopes that they will have governments or individuals in power, be they dictators or supposedly democratically elected, who are favorable to the interests of U.S. and international capital at the expense of the people who live in those countries. So we've seen this with U.S. foreign policy and also, of course, through structural adjustment programs through the IMF and World Bank. We see that poverty is so extremely high in Honduras because they pursued a neoliberal development policy, which is monoagriculture, the building of dams, and these mega projects that serve international capital at the expense of the people living there. And the same goes for Guatemala, and of course Mexico has been on a huge privatization run ever since Enrique Peña Nieto became president. And this is something that the U.S. and the West in general and international capital desires. And then, of course, when the effects of that in the form of migration occurs, they refuse to see the connection and instead demonize the very people who are bearing the brunt of their policies.
Right. You know, as we've talked about before, I mean, the ironic thing is that people see in these people, I don't know, like cartel death squads or something like that. And like, these are people that are like victims of, you know, those forces, and they're trying to come here. And I mean, just like in Syria, you know, people see refugees and they see ISIS. In reality, they're the people that are fleeing ISIS, or in some cases, right, you know, fighting against them. But I guess the next big question is, you know, what do you think is going to happen? Are they going to get to the border, do you think? And what happens if and when they do get there?
We'll have to see. Well, Trump, of course, has been having his racist temper tantrums and, you know, saying that they're going to cut financial aid to El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras. He's been ordering his lackey, Enrique Peña Nieto, to shut down the caravan in Mexico. So if these folks make it all the way to the border, He's also, of course, threatened to send the army to the border and close the border with Mexico, which you can't close the border with Mexico. It's just not going to work. So what will probably happen is similar, I would guess, if I had to make a guess, similar to what happened earlier this year with the caravan,
right,
where in the end of the 1,000+ people who were part of that caravan making its way through Central America and into Mexico, only about 100 went to the U.S. border to request asylum. So if we're at 5,000 to 7,000 people, it's likely that Mexico will try to convince some through incentives in collaboration with the U.S. and Central American governments to return home. Some may choose to stay in Mexico, feeling it's probably safer than trying to get into the U.S. And then a few may go to the U.S. border, where if they go to a so-called legal border crossing, they will be immediately detained, where they have the choice to petition for asylum. Or they may choose to try their luck crossing without papers.
And the right.
So yeah. Into the U.S., yeah.
The ironic thing was that the vast majority of the people that applied to get into the United States last time with asylum status did get in. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people on the right that were very upset about that. But, this is nothing new. This is kind of like how it has been for a long time, that people have actually been allowed into the United States on asylum status.
Exactly. And these are when you have individuals fleeing the circumstances created in large part by the United States and who have the basis for requesting asylum is credible fear, right? Credible fear of prosecution at home or persecution, death threats, violence against oneself, interfamiliar violence or gang violence or persecution by the government. And of course, the Trump regime has made those standards much higher so that it can deny more legitimate asylum requests. Despite this, people are still taking that risk because they really feel there's no other option. And all this rhetoric that Trump is throwing out is, I mean, from his perspective, this probably couldn't come at a better time right before the election, so he can ramp up the rhetoric and light up his right-wing xenophobic base by blaming this, of course, on Soros and the Democrats when they have nothing to do with it. And, the Democrats are – their immigration policy is nothing to be bragging about or supporting either. So
right.
It's a difficult circumstance and really – what these people are doing and how they've mobilized and how they've now made it from Honduras through Guatemala into Mexico and facing down, crossing borders and with their families, children, and fearlessly just trying to save their lives. And it's really incredible.
We hope that you are enjoying this episode of This Is America, or the latest episode of the It's Going Down podcast. We know that a growing number of the proletarian community tune in every week to hear both resistance news and the latest headlines on everything from climate change to Trump.
Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell!
But before you fast forward that dial...
Hell no, it can't wait! Your lives will be affected!
We bring you a special announcement. We need your help this winter in meeting our fundraising goal of $10,000. So if you don't want to see IGD slowing down anytime soon,
say hell no, motherfuckers!
Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Give us a one-time donation, buy some awesome swag, or sign up to become a monthly supporter.
Now, I want you to go in that bag and find my wallet.
Which one is it?
It's the one that says bad mother...
And now... back to the show.
Okay, we're joined here today with somebody in so-called British Columbia. We're going to be talking about a lot of things that are happening up that way. And they've just been doing a lot of stuff. There's a really excellent publication and website that we encourage people to check out called The Volcano that talks about like the intersections between indigenous struggles, homeless struggles, struggles against gentrification and also for housing. There's just been a lot of stuff that's been going on, and also the far right group, the Soldiers of Odin, have also attempted to kind of intervene in this, and they've been coming after homeless camps that people have been defending. And also recently there's even been the takeover of a large building. It was squatted for a couple days.
And we're gonna just 17 hours.
Okay. Well, 17 hours. Almost a day. So we're going to be talking kind of about all these things. But if you just want to introduce yourself and just talk about the group.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Lisson Chen, and I'm a member of the Alliance Against Displacement, or AAD. We are an anti-capitalist, anti-colonial, revolutionary political organization, and we have campaigns all over Southwest British Columbia. Our social bases that we organize with are largely homeless people, also urban Indigenous people, low-income tenants who are facing massive amounts of gentrification and displacement, as well as trans women and sex workers. And a big component over that, about that, in the past couple of years has been helping to organize, set up, and defend tent cities.
So let's just start off with that. This is something that we've heard from people that live in Canada that have lived in British Columbia before, gone through, is just that there seems to be a high level of homeless people out on the street. What are the conditions that have led to that? And can you tell us about the homeless encampments?
Yeah, so British Columbia and Canada, like many parts of the world, have been adopting, right-wing neoliberal austerity measures. And as a result, the Canadian government stopped building social housing or funding social housing in 1996. And additionally, British Columbia's economy has always been centered on resource extraction, but in the city of Vancouver, it's a largely financialized economy. And so I think one of the dynamics is that this focus on financialization has rendered many sectors of the working class highly disposable. So it's increased the amount of homelessness, and an additional component of that is that Indigenous people are disproportionately represented in homeless populations, which of course is just a continuation of the dispossession that Indigenous people have been struggling against for hundreds of years. So with tent cities, the way they work is that we claim public land, and in British Columbia, there have been a lot of organic ad hoc tent cities that have appeared and then been fairly quickly smashed by the state and the police. So how we approach tent cities is when homeless people are interested in creating a longer-term encampment that can provide safety and security, save people's lives, we work with them to create a political statement so that right from the get-go, it's a politicized event, which makes it much easier to fight back against the kind of immediate police and law repression that homeless people face when they're on their own.
Can you tell us about the Soldiers of Odin have been showing up to these encampments? Why? What do they have to gain by attacking homeless people and how do they fit into the mix of all this?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting because the Soldiers of Odin, Discontent City, which is the tent city in Nanaimo on Vancouver Island, kind of made the Soldiers of Odin. So prior to Discontent City, there may be a handful of members, but they weren't active. They weren't really part of the public discourse on Vancouver Island. But my sense is that they were kind of riding on this wave of populist anti-homeless hatred and using Discontent City as a thing that they could organize against and create a platform and recruit out of. So in Nanaimo, there's actually two Soldiers of Odin members who are running for city council, and I just don't think that could have happened without Discontent City serving as this site that they could rally around. So in terms of why the Soldiers of Odin are thinking that it's in their best interest to attack homeless people, I think the way I see it in BC is that the rise in fascism seems deeply tied to a crisis of masculinity, gender anxiety, and collapse of the nuclear family. So especially in the settler colonial context, if you add the housing crisis to that mix, this settler entitlement to home ownership that people are increasingly unable to achieve. I think homelessness comes into it because, homeless people are living in the public realm homeless men are completely failing to abide by the gendered expectation that they, you know, get a job and support their families and their children. And homeless women are violating gendered expectations around women, completely living their lives in the private sphere, in the kitchen and in the home.
What is the political strategy for organizing with the homeless encampments, or are they designed to pressure the city to meet certain demands, or are people trying to build something in the camps themselves? How would you see them?
I think they are more about sites of what we call dual power. Mm-hmm. Of course, dual power historically refers to creating alternatives to a capitalist economy. We don't really have the power to do that right now in BC, but we have shown that tent cities are able to establish land relations, which are a threat to capitalist and colonial property rights. So in terms of the politics there, it's that immediately respond to people's needs to survive. And we initially did start off making demands for social housing with the beginning of each tent city. But in BC, at least, the conversations around housing that the provincial government is having are all centered on super institutionalized supportive housing, which sounds nice because supportive is a positive adjective. But from our experience, we see that supportive housing is basically a form of soft incarceration, completely dominated by social workers that surveils and criminalizes poor people. So in all the tent cities that we've worked in, homeless people have been really adamant about not wanting supportive housing, not wanting housing that feels like a prison, wanting social housing that respects their autonomy. And the provincial government isn't talking about that at all. Like, it's not even on the horizon. So part of the context of the squat was recognizing that the state isn't even remotely talking about what people need in order to survive. So we were really clear with the squat that it wasn't a protest action. It wasn't symbolic. It wasn't about making any demands to the state. It was about taking resources that aren't being used and taking over an abandoned school in order to provide people with homes that the government refuses to even talk about.
Can you just talk a little more about the takeover? I think one of the, for us outside of British Columbia that were viewing it online through like Twitter and stuff, one of the scariest things was that there's a huge police presence. And then also the soldiers of Odin showed up to support the police in the parking lot, you know, against, you know, the occupation. Can you just talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we made our way to the school around 5 p.m. and had one of our members sent out a press release. But the cops got there so soon that they taped off the entire school grounds as a crime scene. So the press weren't able to get in. And at the same time, a mob of anti-homeless bigots formed outside the police line. And within an hour, I would say the Soldiers of Odin were there. So there were about eight people in the mob who were wearing Soldiers of Odin colors. And the fact that they were right there, they were there right away, I think indicates that they're in town. And again, like prior to this Content City, the Soldiers of Odin didn't have any kind of established presence in Nanaimo. So I wouldn't be surprised if those eight people were pretty recent recruits. So they rallied there pretty late into the evening, just making threats, being violent, saying they were going to burn down the building, asking for one of our woman organizers to be brought down to them, yelling misogynistic slurs at her. And of course, anytime one of them did something violent towards a supporter, the cops would back the bigoted mob. And they reassembled the morning after and cheered when the two emergency response teams, which is the Canadian equivalent of a SWAT team, came in. So they had about 50 cops raid the building and take down 24 of us who were peaceful and actually went out of our way to assure the police that we had no weapons and were no threat to them. And after that, the police media liaison even justified the police's actions, saying that this is what the people wanted. The people, referring to this white nationalist-led mob bigots. So, I mean, it's pretty standard story of the cops backing the fascists that we see all over.
I mean, has that been a big story in the local media? Soldiers of Odin coming out. I mean, here in the U.S., you know, the big story right now is the Proud Boys. I'm just curious if there's a similar intensity of the coverage, or if that was something that embarrassed the police at all, or if just people really don't care.
People don't seem to be that disturbed by the Soldiers of Odin. And I think particularly in Nanaimo, that's because they've emerged as such a strong voice on the anti-homeless front, which is really quite normalized in the city. So I think they've really monopolized on that anti-homeless hatred and been able to recruit as a result of it. I mean, I don't think the two members who are running for council are going to get elected, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're just perceiving it as a recruiting campaign.
What do you all see as the next steps in the struggle forward, just in terms of this issue of homelessness itself? What are you all planning to do going forward?
That's a good question. I think we're in the process of analyzing this recent shift, where the state seems to be just coming down really hard with the police repression. So the first couple of years, when tent cities were kind of a null thing, it seemed like the state's response was to tolerate them somewhat. And the courts were also fairly sympathetic to the argument that it's a violation of human rights to displace a couple hundred homeless people who have no homes. But the courts have recently turned, and they're no longer sympathetic, and they're approving injunction to evict tent cities. And at the same time, the state is coming down hard. So not only with the squat, where they sent in 50 cops a day after a peaceful squat started, but with another tent city further south on Vancouver Island called Namegans Nation Tent City, was indigenous-led. The cops not only chased them from site to site, but when they made their way to a provincial campground, which they paid the state to stay at, the province basically turned it into a police operation. They completely shut down the entire campground. They had 24/7 RCMP manning the gate, and they refused to let organizers and supporters in. They were only letting homeless people in and out. So it's pretty clear that the state's tolerance for any kind of politicized, organized action on the part of homeless people, their patience has run out. And like I mentioned with the squat, the focus was to take resources that people need to survive. It wasn't to ask the state for anything. So I think we really have no choice but to continue along that political line and focus on self-defense and building the power that we need to in order to do.
What do you
think? What people need.
What do you think the strategy is there? I mean, like in the U.S., they're, you know, historically they've done things like given people bus tickets and tried to get them out of the city. But at the same time, like kind of like a similar dynamic you mentioned, where they might be somewhat sympathetic or try to work with tent cities at certain times. Other times they'll just come in and, you know, smash them up and destroy people's property. I'm just curious, like, do you think that they're coming down so hard on political encampments just because, you know, that's what the state's designed to do, or they want to send a message to the rest of the population that any sort of, you know, taking over of land and property is going to be met with, you know, an equal force of repression?
I definitely think it's the latter. I think it's a strong message that, I mean, especially for homeless people who, even amongst housing activists, aren't seen as political agents or protagonists of revolutionary struggle. They're seen as this special group that needs charity or a hand up, and not as a group that's deeply part of the working class and deeply part of indigenous community, that because of their relationship to property and the ways in which tent cities and also slots can target property, they're really able to attack at the twin pillar of capitalism and colonialism. I think that's deeply threatening both to people on the left and the right who aren't revolutionaries, as well as to the state. So I think really, especially with the police lockdown of the Namegans tent city, and now in discontent, they're similarly taking measures to have more police and social worker control over it. I think they're saying that we will release limited resources in order to house a portion of the homeless population, but we will not tolerate any kind of organized resistance that keeps up a fight. So, for example, with Nanaimo and Discontent, they released 170 units of used trailer housing, which is meant to be temporary, but I think we can assume is a permanent placeholder. And with Discontent, they're saying people who have made it into those 170 units can stay, and everybody else has to leave the tent city and presumably go into the forest or into the alleyways to die on their own. It's about 300 people in total. So it's a mix of releasing limited resources in cases when they've been pushed by organized resistance, and also wanting to disperse and invisibilize the rest of the homeless population so that they are less of an eyesore, because the optics of homelessness are bad for business.
Let's turn now and talk about colonialism, and also just the indigenous population plays into this. I mean, are there a lot of indigenous people, native people there that are also homeless? And how does this tie into the work that you're doing?
Yeah, there's absolutely tons of indigenous people are homeless. In Vancouver, I think the number is 40% of the homeless population is indigenous. And gosh, I don't know what the general population, how much of the general population is indigenous in Vancouver. I think it's less than 10% though. So it's definitely disproportionate.
Wow. So it's a huge amount.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Namigan's Tent City is a really good example of the kind of urban indigenous politics that are emerging from homeless indigenous people. So the person that started that tent city, Chrissy Brett, is an indigenous woman. And AAD also has a number of indigenous people who are dispossessed from their home territories, and for one reason or another are basically never going to be able to return to those home territories to organize there. So the way we see urban indigenous people is that they're uniquely positioned because they're not on their own territories. They've been dispossessed of their nationhood and their territories, but they're still able to be, again, political revolutionary agents. And I think right now a lot of the discourse on indigenous sovereignty is focused exclusively on land defense. And as I mentioned earlier, tent cities and the squats were really deliberate about articulating these sites as both anti-colonial and anti-capitalist. Whether we're talking about private property or public property, property relations in Canada are a settler, colonial, and capitalist construct. And forcing Indigenous people to adopt property relations, even with their own territories, is part of a settler colonial project. So we really feel that using people's power to assert land relations is in the benefit of both working class people and Indigenous people.
Yeah, do you think that's part of the draw of groups like Soldiers of Odin, and also the state too, is that they're seeing these a growing homeless movement that's like taking over property and land as, you know, also an indigenous movement?
I think to some extent, the degree to which indigenous sovereignty is at the forefront of any given tent city really depends from site to site. Like I said, with Namigan's tent city, it's right there. And so the responses to that tent city have been very obviously anti-Indigenous and racist, but I haven't seen that response as much with other tent cities. But certainly I think that they're striking at the heart of the settler colonial nation state, which is the propertied nuclear family that has, you know, its little homestead.
You know, I think a lot of people listening to this, if they're older, they probably grew up with a project like Funap Bombs. Or if they're younger and they haven't, done that, I mean, I'm sure they lived in an area where, you know, homeless people are just a fact of everyday life in colonial class society. What advice would you give to people that are seeing similar things unfold where they live, especially as just like the economic crisis grows worse? I mean, there's more and more people displaced, more and more people without homes. More and more people, especially in the United States, one of the things we're seeing right now is people that are essentially homeless, but they're living in their cars. And even like some cities, like in Silicon Valley, they're actually the city is working to open up like parking lots for people to live in their cars. And it's, I don't know. And I think that a lot of the organizing that you all are doing is really fabulous, because it's kind of like hitting on to that reality. And I'm just curious, any other insights or any advice that you would give to other people about just the nuts and bolts, or the successes and the failures?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think we should all really interrogate the widespread perception that homeless people are this kind of special social group or in need of charity, and think of them as members of the working class and part of indigenous community, so that they can be central to anti-colonial and anti-capitalist politics. I'd imagine that all over Turtle Island, the United States and Canada, homeless people are forming these ad hoc encampments when they can, because they're objectively safer. They save lives, and they protect people from harassment by, you know, violent members of the public and the police and bylaw. So if I were living elsewhere and not organizing with AAD, and I saw a group of homeless people, I might see if there's anything I can do to support a politicized struggle, especially one that could take over land or take over a building. Because, like you said, when the state's response is to open up a parking lot so that people can live slightly more comfortably out of cars, it is clear that that's about normalizing homelessness and trying to enforce the idea that it's just how life is always going to be. And I think we grapple with that tension with tent cities as well, where as soon as you kind of defang yourself and fit into a legalistic approach, then the state's response is to normalize you and turn you into an outdoor shelter, which is what we see with Dignity Village in Portland. So I think, one, seeing homeless people as political agents and not being afraid of an organized, politicized struggle, and always trying to up things so that to combat the state's oppression, or on the softer side, the state's attempt to normalize any given inhuman condition.
Anything else you want to touch on, or if you want to throw out any links or ways to follow the work that you all are doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the shout out to The Volcano. That's a newspaper that's autonomous from AAD, but a lot of us in AAD are also part of that collective. So you can follow news through thevolcano.org or our website, which is stopdisplacement.ca. We're also on Instagram under Against Displacement, and Twitter under Stop Displacement, with the final E in displacement missing because it was too long.
Hey, thanks for talking with us, and stay safe out there and keep up all the good work that you're doing.
My pleasure. Thanks.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.